listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
Episode 85.
The podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
Occasionally.
Occasionally. We've been very, very busy. We apologize. Well, I apologize. Do you apologize?
I do apologize.
We apologize. We just haven't had time. The podcast is a luxury, and we have not had that luxury. So, what do we have today?
We have today an interview with Professor Sean Carroll, who is a particle physicist. He teaches at the California Institute of Technology in LA, and you can find out about all his doings at preposterousuniverse.com. He has all kinds of both paper and electronic publications, and he's on Twitter quite a lot, and he blogs, and he blogs for Discover as well, but you can find it all at preposterousuniverse.com.
Fantastic science popularizer. And a sweetheart, and
yes,
you
and
interviewed him.
Honored me with an interview, and here it is.
Enjoy.
I first met you when you were on a panel at the University of Michigan, where you had been asked to speak about Einstein on the Beach, which is the big Philip Glass opera that I'm currently part of.
Sure. Everyone should know right off the bat that nobody in their right mind would ask me to talk about Einstein on the Beach, the opera itself. I didn't even get to see it. We were supposed to see the performance that you were in the night before the panel, but it was in Michigan in January, so you can guess what happened. We got snowed out and didn't get in until everything was done.
I remember it well.
Yes. but I can testify that various local physicists who did go and who were not obviously inclined to love it from first listen, did really get into it, and they had a great time at the opera. My expertise is on the Einstein side of things, not the beach or the music side of things. I'm a theoretical physicist at Caltech, and I do research on cosmology, field theory, gravitation, and I've written a graduate textbook on general relativity, which was Einstein's big achievement. So I am supposed to be able to talk about what Einstein did and why it's all important.
You also gave a beautiful talk at TAM 2012, the amazing meeting over the summer, that was even a little more wide-ranging than that.
Yeah, you know, like some people, I was born with the pundit gene, and I'm convinced that everyone needs to know my opinions about many things. So that's why I have a blog, and I'm very interested more seriously in writing about lots of things, and they seem disconnected, but to me, there is an underlying unity of trying to understand how the world works, and whether or not that is through doing science or connecting what we learn through science to questions of human life and philosophy and morality and meaning, or questions of religion and ontology and the metaphysics of the deep structure of the world. I'm interested in all those things. So, I'm glad you liked the talk at TAM. Thank you very much. That was, an attempt to talk about human life in a context informed by what we know about physics.
Yeah, it was really lovely because you sort of got into the idea of morality, but without trying to do, I won't name names, but without without trying to do the science can inform us about reality or about morality.
Morality.
That was an interesting Freudian slip. Science can inform us about reality, but you did not suggest that science can tell us what morality is. But maybe I should let you say it in your own words. You had a slightly different turn on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way you put it is exactly right, and there's a distinction that people seem to not want to quite appreciate between the question, can science inform morality, and does science determine morality? And, people just love going to the extreme locations in opinion space. So there are people who think that science has nothing to do with morality, and there are people who think that science will eventually overtake all of morality and tell us right from wrong. And I think that even though it's clear to me that we should base our notions of morality on the right view of how the world works, which is given to us by science, I also don't think that knowing the right way that the world works is enough to tell us right from wrong, or will ever be enough. It's not that we don't understand it well enough. It's that all science does is tell us what happens in the world. It doesn't tell us what should happen. And we need to sort of reconcile the idea of morality as another layer that we put on top of the world. And science doesn't give it to us, nor does God or the universe itself or nature or anything like that. It's something we have to invent in a way that's going to make us happy.
Yes, I think that, as I recall, the beautiful way you put it, Tam, was that we have to decide what kind of world we want to live in, and science can help us make it that way or discover whether it is that way or not.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's up to us to decide, and the reason why people don't like, very, very few people really like that attitude, because they say, well, if I disagree with somebody else, if someone thinks that all women should wear burqas or whatever, then I can't prove them wrong using science or religion or anything like that, and that upsets me. And my response is just that the world is not out there to keep you happy about these things. And it's not a matter of whether, you know, you feel yourself insufficiently armed for the battle. Just because moral choices are not determined by science doesn't mean that they don't exist and that we cannot discuss them and work within the things that we do agree on to make a society that we all agree is just. And the people who don't agree, how do we treat them? We treat them the way that we actually always do treat them, which is that, you know, we put them in jail if they're going to keep going around killing people or whatever it is. We're just describing the world as it actually is. It's not something you should be unsatisfied with.
Speaking of women in burqas, I noticed that one of your latest blog posts, you blog for Discover, right?
And right. Also,
yeah. One of your latest blog posts was about an unfortunate but interesting study about women in science, or rather scientists' attitude towards women.
Yeah, you know, this is, as I open the post by saying, and anyone who has followed the literature on this with an open mind has known this for a long time, but over and above all the distracting conversations about who is best at doing math and genetics and things like that, it is clear to any objective observer that women, among other groups of people, are systematically biased against in academic science. And whatever the, you know, intrinsic ability issue is, and I happen to think it's essentially equal between men and women, but I'm happy to be proven wrong using science, I would still like people with the same ability to be treated the same.
Yes.
And a new study came out saying that that's just not true, that they, you know, they gave a bunch of scientists resumes for people who are applying purportedly for a job as a lab manager, and they asked them to rate the resumes and how good they were. And the resumes were all identical, but the ones to which a female name was attached ranked consistently worse in the subjective evaluations than the ones to which a male name was attached.
And this is just horrifying.
And it's true whether or not the evaluator was male or female.
Yeah.
And it's because it's not a matter of evilness. It's a matter of we live in a society where there are certain assumptions and expectations, and those assumptions and expectations are sexist in many you know, hidden ways. And recognizing that that's true is the first step towards noticing it ourselves and making it go away.
And there we go. Science has shown us that it is true, despite what we might protest.
You would like to think that, but if you read the comments on my blog post, you would realize that science is not enough to convince everyone of that fact. You
know, even scientists.
Yeah, they will always find ways to justify the beliefs that they want to have and to make them feel good about themselves.
Oh, right, or to deny that they actually do have those beliefs that they're shown to when they're not paying attention.
Well, but that's the thing. So here we have a study, you know, science, that says, look, people do discriminate against women. So, you know, you could just ignore it, but the commenters in the blog post have more or less given up on ignoring it and are now arguing that the discrimination is all rationally justified. It's not that it's not there, it's that they have good reasons to discriminate against women. So at least that's a tiny bit of progress, that the ground has shifted beneath them.
I didn't get that far in the comments.
That's okay. I have to do it because I need to weed out the especially vitriolic comments.
Internet seems to attract.
They do it. You know, we have better than average commenters, so I don't want to give people the wrong idea. Most of our commenters get it and are interested in fighting the good fight and so forth. But, you know, it's the crazy people who want to raise a ruckus that are going to attract all the attention, which is the curse and blessing of the internet.
Yes. Well, maybe we should circle back to Einstein. I know you didn't see the opera, but at least Philip Glass and Robert Wilson, when they talk about it, they tend to talk about Einstein in terms of his cultural impact, and some of that does have to do with morality and the perceived metaphorical morality of a lot of his theories in the popular culture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And part of that, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Einstein, his celebrity is utterly deserved, right? He really did do amazing things. He was probably, by acclamation, the greatest scientist of the 20th century. It's not just a pop culture phenomenon. But there is a temptation to think that, okay, therefore he's a very wise person and we should listen to what he says about morality or politics or anything else. And I'm a big believer that we should let people like Einstein and me talk about politics and whatever else we want to talk about, but we should judge what we say, what those people say, on the basis of whether it's sensible or not, not on the basis of whether or not they're also a good scientist. Einstein is so far up there in the intellectual stratosphere that things that he says get an aura about them, and there's this miniature industry in fabricating quotes that Einstein reportedly said and misunderstanding quotes that he really did say. But it's very, very interesting to see how people do relate to him. And frankly, you know, they could do worse. Of all the people, if you want to raise someone up there as a guru, you could do a lot worse than picking Einstein.
How do you think that his the legacy of that has come down to us now in 2012? How do you think that people perceive Einstein as a maybe not a moral figure, but a cultural force?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's good parts and bad parts, as is going to be inevitable with any sort of cult of celebrity. When you see pictures of Einstein, when I give talks about cosmology or general relativity, I always show pictures of Einstein from his youthful days, from the period between 1905 and 1916, roughly, where he was really changing the world every other day. And because the picture that comes down to us is one of Einstein, you know, from the 40s and 50s. He's an avuncular guy with the unkempt hair and the sweaters and everything. And it's part, you know, part of that is a little calculated. You know, he kind of enjoyed the absent-minded professor kind of reputation. But as a younger guy, you know, he wore three-piece suits and his hair was combed. And he's not just a wise old guru. He was smarter than everybody else. He was really a sharp guy. And that part, you know, the part of, you know, the guy sitting in his office slaving over equations late into the night and just working harder than everybody else doesn't get passed down as much. There's a thing that we do in society where we attach an almost magical or mystical ability to people who are great thinkers in any field, and we pass by the actual concrete steps that it takes to make those breakthroughs. So again, I'd much rather have Einstein be someone who is looked up to and have posters on the wall of him than many, many other people. But the Einstein, the real person, and Einstein, the scientist, does not quite match up with Einstein, the popular figure.
What do you think it is that people look up to in Einstein? Why do they put posters of this scientist on their wall?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, it's really the perfect storm of scientific celebrity in some sense. He wasn't just a great scientist, but number one, his greatest contribution, the theory of general relativity, the idea that space and time are curved and that's what gives us gravity, really came from him. You know, there's no ambiguity. It wasn't the overwhelming majority of theoretical advances in science really do happen piecemeal. Quantum mechanics, for example, there were dozens of people involved in putting it together. But general relativity is just Einstein. He just went further than anyone else and he got it. And the kind of thing he was talking about is truly mind-bending, right? Space and time being curved and dynamical and changing, later giving rise to ideas like black holes and the Big Bang that really alter our picture of the world. So it's not just, you know, a minor, you know, an important but rather technical advance. It's a literally worldview-changing kind of advance. And then finally, he did have a very, very strong interest in politics and pacifism and, you know, trying to make the world a better place. And, you know, he campaigned for that and people responded to that. I'll never forget in if you ever saw the original version of the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, the alien comes down and he seeks out the Earth's wisest person, Earth's smartest man. And everyone knows who it is. Like, oh, yeah, we know who you're talking about. We'll bring you to this guy. And it's Sam Jaffe, but he's playing a character that is clearly Einstein, right? That is modeled after Einstein. So we sort of long for the day when an alien will come down and say, who's your smartest person? And we will all know who it is. You know, today, like, well, you know, who's the smartest person? No one would agree on that. But when he had Einstein around, then he knew who it was.
Yeah, I feel like we've lost that a little bit. It's interesting to be, this is, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent about this opera for just a second, but it's a little strange to be performing this huge work about Einstein in 2012, and we hear Philip Glass and Robert Wilson say things like, well, we didn't have to have a narrative in this opera because everyone knew the story of Einstein in many, in great detail. And so we could make this thing that has no plot and no characters and no story. And today, I don't think that people have that same relationship with Einstein. He's become a bit more of a distant figure.
A little bit. I do. I think everyone recognizes the name Einstein, but he's certainly become more distant. I mean, you know, the Alpers from the 1970s, right? So
exactly, from 76.
They were closer to the day that Einstein died than they are to today when they were writing that opera, just to put it in perspective. But also, there's no other scientific figure you could possibly pick today that would have that kind of resonance. Probably the closest is Stephen Hawking, or maybe Carl Sagan, who's been also been dead for a while. But neither of those guys, as hugely as I admire them, as admirable as they really are, their scientific contributions are just on Einstein level, because very few people's are. So we don't have that perfect storm today of celebrity and true scientific accomplishment. And partly it's just an accident, partly it is because of different trends, but no, I certainly do wish that what scientists do was more part of the popular discourse than it is today.
Although in some ways it has become more so. There are so many more popular books on science. There are so many more, at least semi-scientific things on TV. And I feel like there is actually a lot more popular understanding of some of science.
I would like to agree. I don't have data, so I can't be objective. But I do also share your anecdotal impression. And I think a lot of it is actually, you know, kind of, we don't deserve it, but a lot of it is because of the tech boom, right? It's just clear that technology is all around us in a much more in-your-face way than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And people get that this technology is somehow connected to science, right? They get that much.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, in my honest moments, it's not at all connected to my kind of science. You know, I'm thinking about the Big Bang, and that is not going to make you a better iPhone. But
Einstein's theories did.
They did in a tiny way. You know, they helped with the GPS system. And
right.
But yeah, I do think that partly as a result of this fact that technology is so much more every day now, there's been a cultural shift where we get things like the Big Bang Theory on TV.
Yes.
And, you know, nerd celebrities, nerd culture, superhero movies being very popular, TV shows that use science and forensics and data analysis and things like that. And I do
usually very badly.
Usually very badly.
But prominently.
But, you know, if it gets some 12-year-old interested and inspired in this, then I don't care, right? You know, they can get the details wrong.
Yes, hooray to that.
The idea of a sitcom on a network television show is not to be a documentary and teach you science. It's to make people laugh or make people think or whatever. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of room for improvement in TV and movies as far as the portrayal of science is concerned, but it's a lot better now than it was just 20 years ago. And part of it is this feeling that the products of science are here shaping our culture in very deep and profound ways. And so people have become a little bit less resistant to that. And if we scientists can somehow take advantage of that and ride that wave and make people more interested by the substance of the science that is being done, then that would be a great move forward for us.
I hesitate to say, but amen.
Go ahead, amen.
So before we run out of time, I just want to see if we can touch on a little bit of science. I've been interviewing scientists that I meet through this opera, who've spoken on various panels around the world. And since you haven't seen the opera, but there's a lot of imagery that people connect easily with Einstein, like trains, multiple trains,
right.
And lots of diagonal lines.
Light cones might be in there somewhere, yes.
Sorry, what was that?
Light cones. Or where the
Light cones. There are, as far as I know, no light cones. What are light cones? We explain.
Well, those diagonal lines that you're talking about, I presume, are inspired by light cones. The light cones are just the sort of graphical way, if you were to draw a picture of space-time on a piece of paper, how do you represent that in Einstein's universe, there's no such thing as two events happening at the same time far away? There is the speed of light. There is this limit to how fast you can possibly move. So when you draw a picture of space-time, rather than drawing, you know, space and time, you draw light rays moving away from every point, and they form a little cone in space-time, which tells you how the world is allowed to operate.
Oh, yes. The diagonal lines, some physicists from the Perimeter Institute came to the show when we were in Canada, and they recognized the diagonal lines, which most of which are moving diagonal lines, dancers moving in constant diagonal lines, and they associated them with the map of the photon bouncing between two.
Ah, okay. Well, the bouncing photon is, yeah, and he's basically a reflection of it's a version of what I just said about the light cones, that it's convenient when we draw space-time. If you imagine, you know, here in space, in your room, if you have two mirrors and there's a photon bouncing back and forth between the two mirrors, it just forms a line, right, going back and forth if you were to look at it. But then if you plot that in space-time so that you have time, you know, running upward on a vertical axis and space running right and left, it bounces back and forth in a diagonal because light always moves at exactly the same speed. That's the implication of relativity. So what the big challenge, once Einstein comes along and explains that space and time are relative, the big challenge is relating times and locations in one place to times and location in another place in the universe. And the best way we have of doing that is bouncing photons back and forth. And when you draw them, they make diagonal lines.
Right. And the idea being that the diagonal line is longer than the straight line. And therefore, since the light is moving at a constant speed from a different perspective, it's going to appear to take longer to move what should be the same distance.
Well, it's interesting. If you have two points in space and you walk between them, you know that the shortest distance is the straight line. And if you wiggle back and forth, you're going to always take a longer amount of distance, right? And so Einstein comes along and says there's something very similar in time, that if you go from the same event in space-time, the same place and time, to some other event in the future, a fixed space and location and time, then you can take the straight line path, or you can zip off in your spaceship and go close to the speed of light and then come back. The difference is that instead of the distance you have traveled, you keep track of the time elapsed along your journey, and the longest time elapsed is when you go in a straight line. By moving out there near the speed of light and coming back, you actually experience less time than if you had just stayed still. That's why time and space are different, despite the fact that they're part of the same thing. In space, the shortest distance is a straight line. In time, the longest time is a straight line.
Every time I have this explained to me, I feel like I understand it. It's brilliant and simple. And then I turn around and I can't re-explain it. It's It's quite amazing. Now, I asked a question a little while back that turned in a certain direction, but that was about the kind of metaphorical implications that society, some of popular culture has taken from the ideas of Einstein, such as the word relativity, and that it has turned into, in my opinion, unfortunately, into an idea of moral relativity, and that science has a moral relativity. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think that's just an unfortunate spin-off of the inevitable fact that we adapt the English language, or in Einstein's case, the German language, to talk about new concepts in science. So we always repurpose old words to talk about new things, and then people think we're talking about the old thing when we're really talking about the new thing. So Einstein's theories have absolutely nothing to say about whether morality is objective or subjective or relative. And it has nothing to say anything except that how we measure things in space and time is relative to what a particular observer is doing. Now, this might be inspirational or metaphorical or, you know, spark some creative thinking in you, and all that is great. But to actually rely on, to actually point to the theory of relativity or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to have any implications for morality directly is a little bit of craziness.
Do you think the fact that most of us can't easily understand the scientific ideas makes it even more dangerous?
Well, I think that everybody should, you know, just be a little humble about these ideas. And that goes for professional scientists as well as everybody else. And I say that only tentatively, because there's humility and then there is sort of ignorance. You know, we should be careful when we're faced with new ideas and concepts and we are eager to apply them somewhere. We should be careful that we know what we're doing before we do it. You know, I wouldn't try to get big implications from the uncertainty principle or the theory of relativity if I didn't really know what those meant. But I'm not against doing it. I just think that, you know, we have to admit that these are ideas that were developed by really, really smart people thinking really hard for many, many years. And they're probably not that obvious, right? You know, they're probably kind of subtle. We should think carefully before we apply them blindly.
Yes. Well, on that note, we are about out of time. And I just want to close with this, my very first impression of you, and one of the big reasons why I so wanted to interview you, was that I went to this panel where you were speaking with Philip Glass, who's a world-famous composer and a household name amongst musicians and moviegoers, and a famous guy.
Yep.
And then there was you on this panel, a physicist. And after the panel that was in an auditorium, which had probably 800 or 1,000 people in it, I tried to go up and talk to you, and the line of University of Michigan students and attendees to talk to you was enormous. There were all these people getting your autograph and so excited to meet Sean Carroll. And there were just a couple of people talking to Philip Glass, and I thought, what, that is so great. This is yet more evidence that science is popular and people are excited about this.
You know, I don't even think that Philip Glass has a Twitter feed, so I don't see how he expects to get any attention whatsoever in the modern world. So, you know, whereas I'm kind of shameless about those things.
Yes, your blog is great and your Twitter feed wonderful. I highly recommend to anybody who happens not to know your work.
Well, I have fun doing that. And I also have to say that, you know, just to point out the reality of it, Philip Glass was incredibly gracious and a great guy to talk to. He was very, very good on the panel. We were told ahead of time, I don't know why, but we were told that he likes to do all the talking and not let anyone else get a word in edgewise, which was completely the opposite of the experience we had. And he was legitimately very interested in what the scientists up there were doing and had to say. So, you know, I think that when artists and scientists get together to talk about things with open minds, a lot of great things really happen, and that was certainly an example.
Well, yes, I agree. Do you have any books that you'd like to mention to our listeners coming out?
Well, yes, now that you mentioned that. Two things. If you're really interested in light cones and relativity and how time works, I did write a book about that called From Eternity to Here, for the Ultimate Theory of Time. And just next month, or 2 months from now, I guess, in November, I have a new book coming out on the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider called The Particle at the End of the Universe. So if you want to know what all this Higgs boson, God particle, as it is sometimes unfortunately called, excitement is about, the excitement is right there in easy to read and to gift form.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Sean Carroll.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Sean.
Right. Thank you, listeners, for listening. Thank you, Sean, for talking.
Right. Well, thank you to... Wait. Okay, yeah. I'm not gonna... Yeah.
And hey, guess what? We don't have to make excuses for not being scientists this time.
Right, because we didn't say anything. Though I wasn't... I was quite impressed at how you sort of started talking relativity with Sean Carroll.
Oh my gosh, but I got it really wrong.
He was very kind to you.
He was very sweet. It's true that every time I have that explained to me all the time and I feel like I understand it and a light bulb goes off in my head. I think, oh, I've got it this time. And then 5 minutes later, that's the way.
Well, you don't have the math. There's a limit to... Actually, I'll take this to a moment to recommend. I just read that book by Brian Cox and the other physicist who's not as famous. Sorry. Called
Jeff.
Why Does E Equal MC Squared? And it's a wonderful book. It's not very long. And it just goes into... It just takes that equation and it just goes through and explains everything behind it. And, you know, the most famous equation in the world. And, you know, what the hell does it mean? It's a wonderful book. But same kind of thing. I was, like, reading it. I had all these, like... Oh my God, I understand relativity moments. And then like I go and have a yogurt and I'm like, what was that again?
So you can't explain to me why E equals MC squared.
Read the book.
I am halfway through. It's a great book.
So,
but there are some great books by Sean Carroll too. You should go out and buy them.
Yeah. And I have no idea when the next episode is going to be. And we will, you will know when it is because it will appear in your feeder.
Thanks for listening.
To Scopes Monkey Choir from scopesmonkeychoir.com. See you next time.
We're going to see them.
Yeah.